You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, my name is Sue Nelson, and for the next hour we're going to be talking about all things food. I'm joined by my lovely fellow presenter, Guy Routledge of Sapling Digital and The Food Rush, but Ollie's not here again.
He's slacking off again.
He is really slacking off, so it's just you and me.
Well, and our three lovely guests.
Of course it is, yes, but just you and me today, so that's lovely. I've got three guests. I've got Philip Shaw of Savanac Knives, so we're going to talk about knives and cutting things. He's got a very, very ruthless looking knife on the table in front of us.
It looks absolutely stunning.
Scares me a little bit. Jamie Crummy of Too Good To Go and Paul Woodward of Green Cola. So we'll be coming on to you later. But we're going to start off by talking about knives. Now, last Sunday, I decided to cut some oranges up because these guys here, Ollie and Guy, made me buy a food hydrator.
Dehydrator.
That's it, then things.
Not a hydrator.
Oh, no, dehydrator.
That's like the opposite of what
dehydrator.
A dehydrator
is. I was going to make myself some nice little, the orange. You know, they're lovely.
They are tasty. You know, we do like to give each other a hard time on this show, too. But the dried orange slices were delicious.
Yeah.
Very fresh.
I was cutting the skin off this time because
it was a bit too bitter. Mm. You know, I'm glad you're learning.
Anyway, I did that and I got a knife and I cut straight the way through my thumb, which was, pretty good. And you know, when you do it and you don't look at it and you go, that is.
You know, it's the worst ones when you don't feel it immediately
because the adrenaline just
kicked in.
I knew it was really going to be bad.
Yeah.
Anyway, I couldn't be bothered to go to hospital, so I've tried to patch it together and it doesn't, frankly, it still doesn't look very good. So
I
might have to go.
Did you stitch it up yourself with a needle and thread?
It's hard when you only got one hand left, isn't it?
It is,
I didn't know what to do, so I just wrapped it in a tea towel and just tried to wait.
I'm
for
a bit squeamish, so if I faint, then just
No. So anyway, I'm still not looking good. But so can you tell me, Philip, how are you supposed to use a knife so that you don't do what I did? Are there some knife skills that you should be doing? Because actually, cutting through your thumb is pretty stupid.
No, it's pretty painful. I've done it myself a few times, I sympathise completely. I think the most important thing is just to try not to keep, when you're chopping with a knife, just look what you're doing. But I think it's
look what you're doing. Keep
your eye on what you're cutting.
Look what you're doing.
We make knives and we make very sharp knives, which is the whole point of them. And even you can speak to a professional chef and they will
still be doing
they
it will be,
everybody cuts themselves at some point, so you're not the only person.
But it feels quite stupid.
But it's worse if you've got a blunt knife. I hear that you're more likely to slip and cut yourself with a blunt knife than you are with a sharp one.
No, I really, really sharpened mine, which is which is why it's really did
it went nice clean though.
And the other thing I think is make sure that the surface is dry, because if you're trying to do stuff and your surfaces are slippery or your cutting board's wet, that's a recipe for disaster as well. So coming back to you've got this what is that particular knife called? So it's got a beautiful wooden handle and it looks like one of those like chopper.
It's one of our favorites actually. It's called the Savanac knife, and just describing on the radio, it's a veggie chopper. It's a big veggie chopper. We nicknamed it the veggie beast at one point, but it's a great knife to bring along to try and describe how we make our knives, because if you put that into your hand,
I put it into the one that's not cut
yes,
and you're it feels
probably
lovely.
Think it's slightly lighter than you'd expect it.
This is absolutely beautiful. So I'm just going to describe. It has got a beautiful wooden handle, and then you've got the metal running through the handle. So I presume that the wood goes either side of the metal. The handle isn't attached.
It's a full tang blade, and that's a walnut handle. But the way that we manufacture the knives, we use CNC milling, which allows us to put a hollow grind into the blade. So traditionally, most knife makers will have to at some point go out to a flat surface to put to actually shape the blade. But because we mill the blade, it allows us to scoop out more metal. So it's a lot lighter for one reason. So
it's a beautiful shape.
Thank you.
It's a sort of chop chopping chop thing that you would expect.
It's got
however, well, that's the technical term, I believe.
Yeah, I'm just saying here. Paul Woodward has just been leaning backwards. He's not entirely. You're not entirely happy with me wielding this, are you, Paul?
I'm feeling at risk.
Yeah, you're at risk. Yeah, don't worry. We've got insurance. No, it'll be fine.
Just don't cut through the cables either.
Yeah, but it's beautiful. So when you go down to the edge of the knife, it's been honed so that it's almost little triangular in a way. It's absolutely beautiful.
So if you look,
I'm going to hand that to you, Paul. Just have a look. It's absolutely amazing.
If you look from the spine, you'll see it's concaved. So it's, you can actually sort of, so if all the way from the bottom of the blade, it's the thinnest part of the blade. And that's the art of a hollow grind. And it allows, from a cutting point of view, you're using the thinnest part of the knife all the way through, which goes back to the lightness. And also, as you're sharpening a knife over the years, you've got a much thinner piece of metal to be going through. You know, every knife at some point, you're going to start to take away the metal. It always, from a point of view from sharpening, it's the actual geometrics of the actual knife is something that
it looks absolutely beautiful.
Thank you.
So Savanac knives, you work from an old carving barn on the edge of the Savanac Forest. I didn't know that there was a Savanac Forest, so I'm sorry about that.
No?
But it's near Marlborough in Wiltshire. And I guess what you're trying to do is get the best of sort of modern technology that you can with very, very traditional craft techniques and combining those two things to come up with something incredible.
That's correct. We spent nearly over 2 years in research and development, and we only launched the business this last year in July.
Oh, wow.
But we went about this, really started off as a hobby, and we looked at every single metal, and we learned how to make knives the old-fashioned way, which is forging with normal steel. But we realized that actually, you know, to make a bespoke knife, we had to sort of work out how we could do that. So we actually went out to companies, and there was no one making bespoke or customized knives in this country. If you wanted to do it, you'd have to go to probably about 8 different companies, and it was probably costing the region of £6,000-£7,000, and it could take months for it to happen.
So, and by that, you'd have a bespoke one just because it was a design that you wanted? Okay.
And so as a chef or as a keen cook, if you wanted to have a bespoke kitchen knife made, there's no one in this country could do it. So that's the 2 years that we sort of spent in developing that was looking at how we could use 3D design and 3D manufacturing tooling and techniques, which has allowed us to get to where we are now, but also combining that with the feel of a lovely old knife. So you've got a lovely old wooden handle, or you can use any type of material, but it's, you know, the feel and the look looks quite old-fashioned, but actually in terms of the technology of how it's come about, has been the same way as Formula One technology is what we're
having. So CNC tooling is what any factory would use in order to make, it could be anything in manufacturing, it could be kitchens, it could be cars, it could be anything. And that's a traditional technique in a factory, isn't it, CNC tooling?
Yes.
But you're using that to make knives.
Yes, and we're the only people.
What does the CNC stand for? I'm not familiar with my manufacturing.
Computer terminal. something.
So you've got...
Everybody just calls it CNC.
CNC, but it's CAD and CAM. So it's computer-aided design and computer-aided manufacturing.
Cool.
And traditionally, you see a lot in, especially in Formula One, that's how they make all their engine parts.
Mm. But it's very precise, isn't it?
It's precision cutting, and we make precision tools, essentially.
Mm. It just that it happened to be for your kitchen.
And it so happens to be for kitchen knives.
Now, you've got three different types of knives. You've sort of got the core, esoterica, and bespoke. And the core range, I mean, some of them are absolutely beautiful. I've been on the website this morning, haven't you?
Guys? Yeah. I was watching some of the videos how they make them. We can maybe talk about that later.
I just want to own one as a thing because it's beautiful.
I cook a lot at home and have invested in some really good quality Japanese knives.
Are you lusting after?
But
these?
I'm looking at these. But then I saw the prices; they're quite pricey.
Well, the core range goes from 180 to 320. The esoterica from 150 to 600.
And this is per knife.
And bespoke ranges from 750, which one might expect, I think.
Absolutely.
But the point is, if you get a really good knife, I presume you can have that for your whole life, really, as opposed to mine last about 2 or 3 years.
Yes, they're guaranteed for life, and they are tools which you would hope for last for life. But the bespoke side, which it's 750 is the starting price, but what we do in that whole process is once we've got a design down, we then... develop the actual design onto the computer. We then make a prototype, which is manufactured in exactly the same way as making a normal knife. And then that individual can then have that prototype. They'll work with it for how long ever they want, and then they bring it back to us. And so it's the only way for us to actually establish whether we got that initial design right. Mm. And once that design has been finished, we then make the final knife. So it takes us about 8 weeks to do the whole process. But in terms of getting a bespoke knife, then that's the only way we can actually properly...
Wow.
But that's still very fast compared to what you were saying earlier when using lots of different manufacturers and piecing it all together, and then there's no one person owning the process. So, still 8 weeks for something bespoke is... impressive.
Mm. You'll have a lot of there's a lot of artisanal companies who will be forging knives, and they generally will take up the waiting list could be to 7 to 12 months.
So what does forging knives mean? Literally, so you're melting
the, oh you're yeah. taking steel and you're bashing it and you're shaping it and you're
like a horseshoe.
Exactly. Yeah. But you're very limited to what you can actually achieve. You could possibly do one-off designs, but in terms of being able to say, right, I want that knife to be a millimeter short there, or just to, you know, to design, we worked with one chef the other day who had huge hands, a big bear of a man, and he kept on, every time chopping, his knuckles were always hitting the deck.
Yeah.
So it could be the smallest thing, but when you start thinking about it, and if you're a chef, you can just see people's eyes light up and they say to us, you know, anything, can I do anything? Yeah. And then before you know it, you're off.
Or somebody might have a physical disability, for example, so they might have, you know, I don't know, arthritis or something like that, and find stuff really hard. I mean, that would, if they are a very enthusiastic cook or it's part of their job, I mean, that could be a lifesaver almost, couldn't it?
You're so right. And we designed a knife the other day for a lady who had quite athletic hands, and she couldn't grip a knife very well. So we just made a much bigger handle. And it was quite a small knife, but just, you know, from the point of squeezing, you, again, straight away, you had a nice, you know, and it was all shaped for her in the way that she wanted it.
And that makes her whole life different, because actually it makes her much more independent, doesn't it? And all that sort of stuff. And,
absolutely,
It's good. So we've got this, can you explain the best metal that you could use for a knife, or does it depend on the job that the knife is doing?
We've spent, we've looked at all sorts of different metals, and the one that we finished with is a Swedish stainless steel, which is called Sandvik, and the technical term is 14C2A10. And it's recognised as one of the best knife steels you could use. It's in terms of hardness and edge retention. And just the general sort of the molecular, the whole, how the metal's all formed, it's just the most purest stainless steel you can work with. There's a lot of cheap stainless steels out there, and I think, you know, annoyingly, people sort of get confused by what is good and bad. But, you know, we've used the best stainless steel, and from a chef's point of view, or anyone in the kitchen, you want a metal that's not going to rust. And also you want something that's going to be able to keep its edge. And so that's the steel that we use. We use that for all our knives. Mm.
And then what is the best way to sharpen a knife? Because I've heard lots and lots of different ways of doing it.
Yeah, it's going to ask the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. So some people say you have a steel and you put the steel, you know, at 90 degrees, you know, and it's and you keep that, you know, on the tabletop or whatever, and then you sharpen your knife either side of that. So that's one way of doing it. Other people sort of hold the steel in their hand and it's pointing away from them, and they do that. What actually is the best way to do it?
It's so that's honing, and
right,
it's not actually sharpening,
is it? Oh, is it? Okay,
you're not taking any metal off at all. So it's a bit like putting oil in your car. You need to hone your knife regularly, and if you're in a kitchen, you'll probably hone your knife every time you use it. But then that's if you were to get a piece of paper and so push it down on the table, the paper would bend.
Yeah,
and that's the same thing that's happening to your blade, essentially. So when you hone it against a steel or a ceramic rod, that's just purely getting it back to a balanced edge.
Right.
And then if you have blunted it and it has got blunt, then you sharpen it on a stone. But if you hone a knife regularly, it will make such a difference.
Mm. Right. And you can buy these steels, which are the long thing, sort of ridges against it.
Yes.
Or you can buy these things that are sort of squarer and you just pull across it. Yep. What's the best one to use?
So whetstones are the best way to keep a
whetstone. So an old-fashioned
whetstone. And if you don't want to do that, and if you're just wanting to, you can buy some very good little wheels which you can pull the knife through, and that'll
do it.
That will sharpen it. Yeah.
But it isn't suitable for all types of knives, is it? Because I'm trying to think of the best way to explain this story in as few words as possible. But every year I cook in a professional kitchen at Christmas time, and there's a guy who comes in who loves knives and loves sharpening them from like a meditation perspective. He'll just sit there and sharpen knives for hours. And he has a knife sharpening kit, which he has with him all the time. And then when he does Japanese steel, excuse me, he has to bring special stuff because you can't just like drag it through one of those, like the rollery things. So is it something that you can use for everything?
I think the best thing to always use is a proper stone. It's a whetstone. But a lot of people who, they may not be professional chefs. And so like my mother, for instance, she will just, well, she's a very good chef, but she's a very good cook. But she, you know, for her to sit down and go over a whetstone is not something she, it's, but you know, see, you don't have to be frightened of that. But if you are somebody who loves looking after their knives and understands it, then I think the whetstone is the best way to keep a knife sharp.
And so this range of knives, so if we just take the core range, I know they're expensive, but they're handmade and you get, you know, sort of get what you pay for. So what have you got from small paring knives all the way up, or what sort of knives, what range do you have? And what should you have in your kitchen? You know, do you need more than two or three knives?
I think you need one or two good knives in your kitchen and possibly a carving knife. But we've on our website we've tried to cater for as many different people and different styles of knives as possible, and so the core and esoterica kind of blend that. There's some sort of speciality knives like a bony knife or a filleting knife, but really you need to have, depending on what you like, I think you need a good classic kind of chef's knife and a small pairing.
What is a chef's knife?
Well, this is the confusion, right? What is a chef's knife? I think it's a knife that you can... the knife that I brought today, the Savonette knife, you could use that from chopping vegetables to doing anything with. If you like working with quite a big knife, then that will suit you. But it's just finding one... if you're going for root vegetables or carrots, you want something that you can chop with comfortably, frankly. Yeah. But then if you want to be slicing up, you know, some herbs, you don't want a huge knife for that.
So for me, a paring knife I use all the time.
Yeah, there we go.
And then I've got quite a big knife, which actually Keith Floyd gave to me. Oh. So I keep that because I love Keith Floyd.
Wow, really?
He's been dead for a long time. But because what I find is I used to do quite a lot of events with chefs, you know, so-called in inverted commas celebrity chefs. We would do events and they always used to say when you turn up, it'll be X amount per day, whatever they were charging. But you always had to provide them with a full set of knives. That was one of the requests.
Really?
That I did, brand new full set of knives. And they'd always tell you which ones. And then you'd do that and they'd only use one, which would be their favourite, you know, because it was their size and
I'm
their thing.
They didn't bring
their
own, actually.
But we've worked with a number of chefs over the last year developing the designs that we have now. And what's always fascinated us is that from the bespoke side, we've always made a different knife for the different, you know, each individual.
Yeah.
So everybody's different. And of course, there are, you know, certain styles of knives, but it's just down to the individual. And, it's having one or two good knives in the kitchen. That's all you need.
So when you consider that just ordinary knives, you know, if you get a set of knives, that they're going to cost you £70 or £80, aren't they, at least?
You can get dirt cheap ones for like £20, but you'd end up replacing them every other week.
So to just buy two amazing knives that would suit you is, you know, especially that they're going to last you your whole life, probably isn't quite as expensive as we might think.
My problem is I have OCD and I would want an entire matching set.
That's just to look at.
It is, yeah. But I'm funny like that.
But a good present for a boy.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone's listening and wants to buy me a gift, well then...
I'm not going to buy you one. But it is a sort of, you know, somebody be really... If they are in the kitchen a lot, you know, and they value that sort of stuff. I mean, looking at it, it's beautiful to look at. Somebody would really value that as a present, wouldn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. A question that comes to mind is, so I have a knife block that I put mine in, kind of keeps them away from all the elements and all the grease and stuff that flies around in the kitchen. Is that a good way to store them, or should they be like on one of those magnetic strips or in a drawer somewhere?
I think definitely never in a drawer, because that's not
dangerous.
They bang into things, bang into blunt them. Yeah.
I think a knife block. The magnetic strips are very brilliant. Or you can get these. There's a bamboo. There's sort of like a tub with lots of bamboo straws in, and that's another good way of storing knives.
That's a nice idea.
But there's a sort of suede sheath that I brought it in. But yeah, if you want to put it in the drawer, but at least store it in something. Yeah, I think you want them on display. You want them to be seen in the kitchen.
Not to show off.
Yeah,
I remember spend all that money on a knife and not show anybody, are you?
I went to a lovely house in France years ago, and I remember walking into this brilliant kitchen, and it just had this wonderful array of lots of different old knives with lovely different handles on. But then when you see that and you go into a kitchen, you've sort of got sort of six black handles. It just goes, that's rather boring, isn't it?
And
but
you've got
these handles look lovely.
And you've got these suede sort of sheaths, as you call them here. Is that if somebody buys one, they sort of come in this beautiful smells lovely.
They we work with where we are. We're sort of very close to racing country, and we've got a lovely saddler in Lambourne called EGA Wicks, and they make if anyone wants a sort of a leather holder or a suede sheath, then they make them for us. But they generally just come in a normal packaging.
Fantastic. Yeah. So Jamie, are you a cook in the kitchen?
I dabble.
Dabble.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds like you're being modest.
Well, the other day, I'm big into making soups, actually. So any way to actually use, like, surplus veg. And butternut squash was one thing I was cooking the other day.
Love butternut squash.
But nearly chopped my entire hands off because they're impossible to cut through.
Yeah, they're a brutal vegetable to get through. Yeah.
Not with those knives. Peel them, but I've stopped peeling my squash. I just chuck the whole thing in the oven and roast it, and you get a nice kind of soft, rubbery skin on the outside. It's really tasty.
Mm-hmm. Not great for a salad.
Not great for a salad, I'll chew give you that.
No.
But yeah, I think a blade like that would slice right through that skin.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And are you a chef, Paul?
I'm not a chef by any standard, but I did marry a wonderful cook, and she delights me almost every day with what she cooks. So probably I limit mine to a vegetarian.
She'd love one of those. Vegetarian as a present,
she
you know?
Would love one of those. I'm looking at it with
what's your wife's
with
name?
Her in mind, Kate.
Kate, get Kate a knife. Get on a good side.
Yes, I'm slightly worried by your comment about it would make a good present from a boy. I've got two sons and I wouldn't want to put them in a deal.
Probably not, no. But they're so beautiful. Really and so it's called Savanak, but that's spelt Savanake, N-A-K-E.
Savanake.
Savanak. Knives.co.uk.
That is correct.
And you've got a whole range on there. And there's some great videos, aren't there?
Oh, the video is amazing. It's there's no sound to it. There's no like speaking on it, but it's just like this, you hear the sounds of the manufacture, like the clinking of the steel and the pressing of the buttons.
There's a reverence to it, isn't
there? It's really, really well done. And I just kind of watched it in awe this morning. I was like, I need this in my life.
My wife, Georgie, made the film and... It very patiently had to go through this process of filming, which a number of processes, and I sort of used to come back in the evening and I could hear the workshop going on in the kitchen. We just wanted to try and demonstrate how much goes into making it, but also not anyone having to listen to me mumbling on and actually raise
it's self-explanatory anyway.
No, it really is, absolutely. Yeah, and it really shows the level of care and detail
and you offer a sort of complimentary sharpening service, don't you? So if people want to come and get their knives sharpened again,
And also we sharpen other people's knives, but we just love people coming to see us, and it's lovely to be able to show the workshop off and show what we do.
There you go. And so if you're being inundated now with people turning up.
But no, we say always come back, send it back in the post and we'll sharpen it. But
but do package it up properly if you do that. So we'll put a link from our website on there, obviously. But really should go on. It looks beautiful, and it's the craftsmanship which we need to keep.
And having the right tools, if you're into your food, if you're a foodie, as Ollie would say, you want to have the right tools in the kitchen so that you can make the produce work the best way that it can.
See, it's a shame Ollie isn't he? He'd love that.
Yeah.
Well,
he'd probably try and walk off with it. Yeah,
yeah, I think he would. So thank you very much for that. Jamie Crummy, too hard to go. Sorry, too good to go.
Too hard to go.
Because I'm thinking about
say.
These knives.
Too
sorry
hard
about.
To say.
Too hard to say. Too good to go. Jamie, you're really appalled, aren't you, by the amount of stuff we throw away? And actually having good knives is actually important because actually you waste less, I would suggest. Mm. But that's not all about what you're about. It's the waste that drives you mad.
Yeah, so we're on a mission.
Everyone's having trouble today, don't worry. Yeah.
Monday morning. We're on a mission to really make all food all food produced is food consumed. So we're really trying to change attitudes and perceptions surrounding food in general, and in particular food waste. Because I think we are fairly in the dark, so to speak, about the amount of food that we throw away as a society. And it's something which, is definitely getting more public recognition, and there's a movement towards a public discourse about talking about it, but it definitely doesn't have the status I feel that it really should have in terms of its environmental and social impact.
Mm. So we've had Olio, a great friend of ours, on the programme a lot. Now what they do is that's a sort of a domestic thing. In your neighbours, you can swap food
like
with your neighbours,
people to people.
This is about business, isn't it? And the amount of waste that's going on there.
Yeah, so we are probably, the best way to describe ourselves as a marketplace for surplus food from businesses. So it's working with anything from a bakery to a supermarket, with everything in between. And the food that they have left at the end of breakfast, lunch or dinner service allows our users to pay for it and come and collect it. So it's allowing businesses to recover some of those sunk costs involved in food waste, but also engage the consumer at the same time on this movement towards being more conscious and more aware.
So is it a sort of marketplace in essence?
Yes. Yeah. So a big marketplace for lots of surplus food.
Because there is so much, isn't there, every day? But I mean, one of the things that I'd seen before, like, you, at the end of the day at a supermarket, they chuck out all this kind of fresh stuff with the best before date is that day. So they, you know, they can't sell it anymore. And there was all sorts of legal issues around, you know, giving it to homeless people or, you know, just giving it away or selling it. Yeah, I mean, it seems crazy. So do you guys not have those kind of issues as well?
Well, I guess the way that we're approaching it is it's food which is still good to eat that that day. Mm-hmm. But we operate really as a safety net for these businesses. So if you were going to throw that food away that evening, well, what happens is our users come and collect it during a collection window specified by that store. So the food is still great and still fresh to eat, but it's fresh to eat that day. So we're not telling people that, you know, you're picking up food from a restaurant and it's going to be great for lunch tomorrow. That may be the case, but we're not educating our users or encouraging our users to behave that way.
So the person who comes to collect, they make that decision themselves. You're not guaranteeing, you say it's available today, and then it's up to them to decide, you know,
when they eat it. But we encourage our users and we tell our users that it's all for immediate consumption.
Sure.
Because that way, you know, we're not getting into any sort of sticky water about.
Yeah, because I imagine that'd be very, very tricky to navigate.
Absolutely. Yeah. So give us some examples of the companies that you work with. Give us an example of a supermarket, for example. Yeah, How does that work?
Actually, my favourite place to pick food up from, because I tend to use it a couple of times a week now, is Yo Sushi. So I'm a big sushi fan, which would be great for one of these sharp knives, to be honest. And you'd go there and you pre-purchase for a surprise surplus meal. So I don't know what food I'm going to collect as a user, because the very nature of surplus food is that it changes from day to day, right?
So are you saying then that they predict what they're going to have at the end of the day, or is it that they've finished at 5 o'clock or whatever it might be, and they've got this left over, or do they predict that they're going to have 10% waste, say?
So they're able to utilise the platform to whatever fits into their business themselves. So for a lot of people that pre-prepare food, they often operate in a means of having their fridges at least 2/3 full, because of the way that consumers sort of operate nowadays. No one ever wants to pick up that last sandwich from prep, right? It's sat there. It's nothing wrong with it, but for some reason, we just think that there's something wrong with it. So it's about window shopping, right? Mm. So places like to have their fridges full. And that's where we sort of come in as this safety net. So allowing them to...
So they have their fridges full, even though they know that come the end of the day, they're not
potentially
going to sell
it. Potentially, there may be wastage.
It's kind of crazy, isn't it? I mean, it's almost in the same vein as the, oh, it's got to be a perfect pepper and a perfect apple on the supermarket shelf because people don't buy the wonky produce, which I think we've all, you know, everyone around here would be like, no, bring it on.
It's like being picked for the football team, isn't it? You're the last one left. Nobody will choose you because you must be rubbish.
I always thought that, you know, people didn't choose the last one because we're all so polite. It's like, oh, no, I'll leave that for somebody else.
Yeah, probably. So they might predict, for example, that they're going to have X amount of sandwiches left at the end of the day or something like that.
And then they can update that on a live basis and review it nearer the collection window. So it's about integrating Too Good To Go, our platform, into their daily operations. But we're not making drastic changes and things like that. And I guess it goes back to what I mentioned earlier about it being a surprise aspect as to what a user's going to collect. So
you trot up to Yo Sushi. And you've got 4 pints of miso soup and...
I'd arrive during a collection window and I would be given, you know, a load of different foods which would otherwise be thrown out that day. So I think it's a really cool, liberating experience, really. I think in like a world full of choices, it's great to have like this surprise aspect around it.
And how much would that cost? So say it retails for £10. Mm-hmm. What typically, in terms of a reduction, would you get in price?
So again, in terms of like the pricing model, it operates as a way for businesses to recover sunk costs. It's not about
selling
encouraging,
at a price. Yeah,
encouraging profit, because if we advocated a model like that, it would then encourage more production of food, and then we'd be back to square one, right, where there's more food being wasted. So it's about recovering sunk costs. So in that sense, it's operating sort of about a 60 to 90% off. But again, it's not a discount app, right? It's about involving and engaging people on this fight against food waste. So I guess the main things that we're trying to cover is things like convenience, and we're trying to bring food waste within to the mainstream. So by being convenient, we're trying to populate our app with various amounts of different food businesses. So it could be market stalls, it could be restaurants, it could be supermarkets or bakeries. And then convenient as well in terms of collection windows, and convenience as well in terms of price. Because if it wasn't price sensitive, then as I mentioned earlier, it then can be used as a platform which would encourage more production of food. So we're trying to make a platform that is convenient for our users, and thus bringing this concept of food waste into the mainstream and allowing people to sort of, you know, rescue their first meal and then change their whole sort of conscious and approach to the way that they approach food and food waste in general.
And who are your sort of typical customers who are, you know, from the consumer side as opposed to the clients?
You guys. It would be anyone. No, it'd be anyone really. So anyone with a smartphone and anyone with a bank account. What we do find is our main users are women and between the ages sort of 20 to 35. But again, that's not like a set in stone. We're finding like a massive rise in sort of retired users. Again, you know, we're finding people from, you know, students as well are always sort of a big a big section. But it's
but given the rise in food banks, I mean, surely this could be an alternative to top that up if somebody's, you know, finding that a struggle at the moment.
So sorry.
A lot of people are using food banks because they're struggling in terms of you know, trying to afford food. I mean, that's a great great top up for them as well, isn't it? Is going and, you know, getting something at a really reduced price.
Definitely. So we've been working with the Trussell Trust. We've been piloting a scheme up in Yorkshire, and again, it's about allowing people to enjoy different parts of food and enjoy different cuisines. But it's enjoying it as a user. So what we were doing, we were giving clients from food banks coupons and vouchers to go and collect a meal as a Too Good To Go user. And again, it's none of that sort of differentiation. So it was using it ambiguously, things like that. So it's it can definitely be used as a platform to address social issues as well.
Yeah, very good.
And it's interesting how it's, you know, similar platform to Olio, but completely different angle. And, you know, serving a different part of business.
Your microphone's just gone a bit dicky. I'm going to have a break then while that's happened. Have a little break, and I think you just wobbled a wire. Actually, Guy, I think it's fantastic, Jamie. Really,
thank
really
you.
Fantastic. And if you want to know a bit, of course, it's going to be on our website, as you would expect. But it's Too Good To Go, and presumably you can just download the app, Android or Apple.
Yes, yeah, so it's available for free on Play Store and App Store.
Excellent. Really good idea. That's great. So we're going to have a little break. I'm going to fix. I don't know what you've done over there. And Paul Woodward, we're going to come and talk to you afterwards about green cola, sort of on the same lines a little bit. Hi.
So that's good.
Yeah, a little bit.
Quite okay. Different, but a bit.
So. Yeah, a little bit. So have a break and we'll come back in a tick.
Nice surprise, darling. Something to celebrate?
We've just got a very tasty government cash reward for innovation.
All that blood, sweat and late nights finally paid off then. How come?
Thanks to our buddies at Breakthrough Funding. Yeah! Sorry, just slipped out. It all sailed through painlessly in no time at all. Over 40k, thank you very much, and the planet will benefit too.
And new shoes for me? Cheers.
Your company could qualify for Innovation Cash too. Find out online now by answering just 6 qualifying questions at breakthroughfunding.com. Yeah!
And we're back in the Food Talk studio. Are you with us now? Yes, you are.
Yes, I am. Yeah, I was just mouthing away. Obviously, that was not a very good joke for the listeners, of course.
No, not really. So we've been talking to Philip Shaw of Savanac Knives and lusting after the knives in front of
them. Oh, so beautiful.
Absolutely fabulous. And actually, we were just saying in the break, weren't we, they should be expensive.
They should be, yeah. Something that is handmade and has that much care and attention put into it, you would expect to pay.
Anybody that knows me, yes, I would like one for my birthday. Thank you so much. And then Jamie, Crummy of Too Good To Go. Really good. You got to get that all around the country. You've just got to work harder.
We're in like 18
Jamie, work harder.
Yeah, okay, I will.
It started up in Manchester, was it?
No, so we launched it actually in Leeds and Brighton.
Ah, okay.
So again, one of the reasons for
big
that is
big student cities, aren't they?
Yeah, we were trying to differentiate ourselves from like every other sort of London startup, and on the back of being based outside of London, we were able to pick up quite a bit of PR and actually build great. On the mission really, which was to sort of grow as fast as we can.
Yeah, anything that deals with food waste, you know, gets my vote.
Now, Paul, you're a finalist in our Food Talk Awards, aren't you?
I am.
Yeah,
I am, surprisingly.
No. We were tasting it all, and you got a very strong vote to be in the finals, I seem to remember. So I've got in front of me your green cola. Now, this is years and years and years of you, blood, sweat and toil, isn't it, getting this right?
Well, it's not just me. There's an army of people that believe it. Well, not quite an army, but some dedicated people who believe in a better one.
So are we going to see a green drink, a green liquid poured out of this can?
Well, it's funny that you say that. We get that question quite a bit. And half the people, when we tell them, no, it's not green, are disappointed afterwards.
Well, why'd you call it green cola then? I'm sure there's an interesting story behind it.
There are three reasons why we call it green. The first is that we don't use aspartame or A4SMK, which are the predominant sweeteners in the country. We use a green sweetener. It comes from the stevia plant. The second reason is that we use only natural caffeine from green coffee beans. And our third green element is that everything we try to do is as environmentally friendly as possible. So even at the end of last year, actually, we built the world's greenest delivery trailer, which is only pulled by pedal power.
Amazing.
So there's three reasons why we're green.
That's brilliant.
That is very good. Now, I know that essentially what you're trying to do is make a cola, zero sugar, no one wanted chemicals, additives, preservative, but still trying to get the taste that a lot of people, in inverted commas, believe is, you know, Coca-Cola or Pepsi. You know, they like that sort of taste profile. So it's you trying to achieve that. So it doesn't feel that different, but it's just so much better for you and obviously much more environmentally friendly.
That's exactly right. So we say that the people that we're really trying to reach is everyone, but in particular what we call health conscious pragmatists. So most of us are trying to be healthier in some way or some form and in every day that we, in what we consume. But the reality is that if something doesn't taste great, then we simply won't buy it again. So the main challenge when you're taking ingredients out is to make sure that you're still left with something which tastes fantastic, which this does. And then we know that people will come back. So we do get people who are a little bit skeptical when we say, look, this is an amazing product. We've taken out aspartame. We've taken out phosphoric acid. We don't have preservatives. And we know that in their mind, we can see the cogs whirring. Yeah, but what's it going to taste like? So as soon as they taste it, then we say tasting is believing. And then we've got people hurt because it's quite simply what we call a no-brainer. If I can have the great Coke taste in green cola, but none of the bad stuff, then why would you not buy this?
And it does taste good. I've just tried some.
Yeah, I've already tried it because that's how it got to the shortlist.
But
you haven't had it before.
No, I've not had it before. It's really good. When you often use these artificial sweeteners, or my experience of tasting other things in the past, is, you know, you get that very kind of chemically, I don't even know how to describe it really, but it's...
It just doesn't. Metallic,
it's, yeah, somehow. It's got that kind of weird aftertaste. But this is really, really good, and it doesn't have any of that kind of horrible lingering.
Tell me about caffeine. What is this? I suppose the history of having Coca-Cola and Pepsi and stuff, and that is quite caffeine driven, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. In fact, when we are working at the moment on a caffeine-free version, because a lot of people do say they're trying to manage their caffeine intake. So the caffeine we have in here is what we call a normal level of caffeine that you would get in any soft drink overall. But most of the producers use what we call industrially produced caffeine. And we use our caffeine from green coffee beans, which does actually have antioxidant properties within it. So even the caffeine that's in it, which is a normal level of caffeine, is healthier for you and comes from a natural source.
So where do they get their caffeine from then?
It's a long technical answer, but generally they use big industrial producers of caffeine.
What is it? So what is
as
caffeine?
An ingredient? Like?
Well, I believe, and I'm not an expert, Sue.
You're more of an expert than I am.
I believe that it does start at some point in the chain from a coffee bean, processed to get the cost down that you lose all of those antioxidant properties in the process of doing it.
So it's still from a coffee bean, that's where it's coming from.
And so you're using the green coffee bean, which is the unroasted coffee bean, if I'm correct.
Correct, and that's in the roasting process, you lose a lot of the antioxidant benefits. Mm. So we won't actually claim anything against it, but we do try to make all of our ingredients as healthy as they possibly can, and that goes even as far as using green coffee beans.
And so then how do you extract the caffeine from the green coffee bean, or do you just grind them up and put them in as a powder, or how does it work?
Well, I confess that's a slightly technical, well, very technical question, Guy, and I don't actually know the answer to that one, but I'll get back to you on that one.
Oh, please do. It'd be fascinating.
I mean, he doesn't know. Tell me about stevia, or some people call it stevia. So stevia is this sort of plant, isn't it, native to South America? And everybody's trying to look at decent sugar alternatives. Quite a few of them have their downsides, and stevia is really difficult to work with.
You're correct, absolutely. Stevia has actually been around for hundreds of years, particularly in places like South America and Asia. And the benefit of stevia is it's actually 200 to 300 times sweeter than sugar. But of course, it has no calories and it comes from a plant. And in terms of using stevia, one of the reasons why it's not been around as much to date is that it does have quite a challenging taste. Now, in certain countries around the world, they're very familiar with stevia. So Japan and Greece, actually, stevia sometimes has a slight licorice note to it. And one of the challenges that we've had is how do you get that out so that you don't end up with a licorice-tasting cola? And that's been one of the challenges to date as why stevia hasn't been around in most of our soft drinks more than it is today. Mm. The other big challenge, of course, with stevia is a lot more expensive than aspartame or Isoflavone K, which you get in all of the products around to date. Mm. So quite honestly, the big manufacturers aren't really interested in using stevia because it adds to their cost base a lot, when they know that stevia is a much better, much healthier alternative to the things, the ingredients that they use. So for us, when we start out, we don't have any sugar and we don't have any aspartame. That's a policy. We try to make it as healthy as it possibly can be. But we're also not looking at a product where we're looking at how do we make it as cheap as possible. We are trying to make it as healthy as possible, and therefore stevia is a good option for us.
And how does that impact the price point of a single can?
We're not in control of pricing in the stores, but our cost going in into the stores is a little bit more expensive than Coke. But to put it in perspective, we're not quite in Philips Arena of £750 a knife. a can of green cola will cost you probably 5 to 10 pence more than one of the competitors on the market. So very, very affordable.
But you're kind of swallowing some of that margin rather to still maintain the values of the brand, which is it's going to be a healthier product rather than better for your pockets product.
Yeah, in all honesty, we could make it cheaper than we do, but we don't have the scale of the big guys either. But we're not really interested in taking the cost out. We're more into adding the cost of healthy ingredients into it. And we believe that 5 to 10 pence more for a can of green cola is a price worth paying.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And how are you doing in terms of marketing? Because let's face it, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, you're talking about Pepsi Max and Diet Pepsi and Diet Coke and Coke Zero and all those different things. I mean, they've got a huge budget and huge recognition. How are you waging war against that? I mean, it's pretty tough.
We use the 800-pound gorilla analogy. It's not sensible to get into the ring with an 800-pound gorilla. You're probably going to lose. And many people along the way have said to myself and my business partners, are you mad taking on these big corporate giants? We honestly don't really see them as the competition because you're right, we don't have the money to spend millions on TV advertising or billboards. Therefore, what we're saying is actually we're quite happy to appeal to those health-conscious pragmatists who want something a bit different, probably don't want a big corporate brand, but are happy to step into the arena of saying, I'm happy to do something that is a bit healthier in my everyday life. And therefore, we don't feel that we need TV advertising or billboards. We just need to get out there and talk to people, as many people as we can. Mm. So my business partners and I last year had the privilege of doing a couple of festivals across the country. And we personally spoke to about 20,000 people. And actually, it's something that we love doing, is because we know when we put the products in front of people, we get them to try it. There's that wow factor. And it's really quite magic when they taste green cola for the first time. As I said, they're not quite sure that it's going to taste like their everyday favorite cola brand. And when they do, there's that magic moment. They go, wow, I can have something healthier. It's not very much more expensive. And it's a very easy switch for me to make. So we focus our marketing efforts on talking literally individually to as many people as we can, and we'll continue to do that because it's emotionally rewarding and we think it pays back.
Now, you know, your background, I mean, you used to be a marketing manager for United Biscuits, you know, McVitie's and KP and all that, and then you worked for Martell Cognac, so you do really understand this world, don't you? You haven't, you know, stopped being an investment banker and then done it or done something else. You were from that world anyway.
You're right, Sue. I have spent most of my life, I'm quite old now actually in that respect, in big corporates. And it was back in 2014, I got to the end of a stint with a big company. And
say,
took us to,
say who it is, go on.
It's the Big Red Machine, I call it, who are, I have to say, are a fantastic company to work for. But at the end of that journey, it was a point in time where actually I had to look and say, what do I want to do with the rest of my life? Do I want to continue working for a big corporate? And the answer was clearly no. And for me, it was not just that I didn't want to work for a corporate. I actually wanted to do something I felt made a genuine difference in the world. So most of my time, I've always tried to actually spend developing businesses, because that gives me quite a big buzz, but also to do something that is better for the consumer. And so when this opportunity came along, actually, it was something that was just, it was a match made in heaven for me to get focused on, even though I knew it's going to be very difficult taking on the corporates, having been in that world for such a long time.
And how did you raise the money? Because this is a big operation, you know, developing a new drink, getting it packaged, getting it sold, all the distribution. And you knew what that would be like because you were from that world and you knew how that much would cost. Did that not put you off?
It was quite daunting. But I think if you take... my personal view is that there is an enormous amount of wastage in big corporates. So there are two kinds of money in the world. There is your money and somebody else's money. And when you're focused on starting your own business, A, you need a very sympathetic and trusting investor, which we do have. So Andrew, thank you very much for your faith in us. But we are laser focused on costs in a way that the big corporates aren't, because we need to put all of our cost into the product. And keep that as low as possible to keep the price down for people. So we did do a lot of soul searching in terms of getting the business plan to a point where it was as cutthroat as possible, and has put all of our costs into the product and not into into fancy office buildings, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And Philip, the same for you. You know, you've been all around the world and doing all sorts of very interesting things, and then suddenly decided to do this. That's again... a big decision, and you've got to have premises as well.
Yeah, I think it comes back to, like, Laura and I have sort of changed our careers for 5 years. And
is that because you get found out after four? So you better find another job soon.
Get off and do something different. But no, we've both gone and worked in. I spent a number of years working in East Africa. I was working in South Sudan for a number of years, and I moved into Pakistan, and I was setting up operations for companies. And so we kind of know how to get on and manage large operations, but for us it was about coming back to England. We wanted to come back to England, and we wanted to essentially work for ourselves. So going back to what we were just talking about, I think that was our sort of aim, but that's not as easy. Yeah, and then you came across a gap in the market, and it was where we are now.
But so did you know anything about knives before you started?
No.
That's what I thought.
No, like, Laura, where do you learn?
YouTube and
Google. I was going to say, was it YouTube Google that you knife school at YouTube?
There's a huge amount of information out there. And actually, there's also an amazing amount of people out there who have all wanted to help. We work with some fantastic companies, individuals, from Richard Airy, who provides us with all our metal. And he's a sort of, he's based up in Sheffield. He knows everything about knife making and the suppliers. And as that sort of journey sort of takes off, you open one door and off you go. But we've made an awful lot of mistakes, and but we make a mistake and we keep going.
Fail quickly and move on.
Yeah, but it's we work out of a very old carving barn, which is slowly expanding, quickly expanding. Sorry, and but it's being nimble, and it's one thing which we pride ourselves on, and what we do is we're not we're not sort of coming into this with baggage. We're not bringing age old techniques. We're just saying, right, what's the best way to make a knife? And so that's why we're doing it.
But don't you think that's what you lose in a corporate? Do you not think, Paul, in that some way they can't move quickly? It's not nimble enough. And actually, if you want to be nimble and you want to be innovative, it gets really frustrating inside a corporate.
It can be. I mean, it's big corporates work in a certain way, and they have fantastic processes that enable the business to operate with very large numbers of people. But you're absolutely right, Sue. One of the things I love about this business is that if we decide we want to do something, we look around the room at each other and we decide we would do it because there's no one else is going to.
Hmm. And Jamie, you studied international law. What happened then? Because what we find, I mean, Guy and I both find, with all these people who've gone into the food
industry,
have come from all sorts of amazing backgrounds, often, unlike Paul, often not in the world of food.
Yeah, so it was really like a passion project, I guess. I'd just sort of come back from sort of living and working in the Calais jungle. So I was doing things with refugee rights, and this was something that then sort of springboarded into something else. And I guess my passions have always been social and environmental impact. And this was an avenue which we could express that and really look into a bit further. In terms of how it grew and how it grew really quickly, it just meant that it was deviating from a path, but it was still something where it was a passion of mine to have an impact on both an environmental and social aspect. So I wouldn't say it's massively different. I think some of the skills and things are just completely transferable.
But as Philip said, I presume you've had to sort of change and there's suddenly an opportunity or you've tried something, it's not gone wrong, not quite gone right, and you just go, okay, we'll slightly change that or we'll do this. We all have to do that when you have a new business, don't you?
Yeah, I think that's one of the attractive things of it is you can change completely quickly, and it's about making decisions quickly as well because you need to be reactive. And I think that's one of the really great things about being sort of a social enterprise or a startup is that ability to really react.
And putting money in, Philip, you know, putting money into it is scary. I mean, you've got an investor, you said, Paul, but if you put quite a chunk of your own money in, that's a huge leap of faith. I mean, does that keep you awake at night sometimes, or you just persevere because it's what you want to do?
Well, no, you know, it's everything does keep you awake at night, and money is, you know, makes the world go round. But we went down. It's like sort of you've decided to go down its route, and as each rabbit hole we went down, we've gone back up another few. we know what we're doing now, and it's really exciting. And I think for us, as Jim was saying, I think it's listening. It's listening to what people are saying about what you do. You know, we can think we've made the most fantastic knife, but you know, we look at the prototypes we made 2 years ago and what we're now producing. And it's because we've gone to chefs, we've listened to them, and it's getting their feedback. And they're saying, you know, those are the individuals who are using our product. So we listen a lot, and we go about it. But yeah, no, it's, you know, anyone who starts up their own business, it's a huge risk. But at some point that you've got to, you know, staple your flag to the flagpole and get on with it. And that's where we are.
I went to a new restaurant a couple of weeks ago, and I went in and they were it was the first day they were open, I didn't realise this, I went there for lunch, and they were going around saying, oh, is it okay, and tell us what you want. And now, for me, that was completely the wrong way of doing it, in that they didn't have a vision or you know, they were almost doing everything. So tell us what you want. Da, da, da. You still have to have a very good idea about what you are, what you stand for, what your brand is.
Yeah.
And then you ask other people to refine it. When you don't really know and you're really reacting and ask, people don't actually know who you are or what you are, and actually that can be off-putting. So you've got to have a core of something, haven't you, that you then refine, because people want to know what it is they're buying.
Yeah, and that was, you know, where we started, and the core range essentially is how we, that was a sort of collection of knives which we just thought, right, that's it. You know, and we've still got them, we still, and they're the most popular selling knives. And you know, this year we're about to launch as a barbecue range of which we've after working with.
Look at guys' eyes light up there.
We've got Neil Let's Rankin on board, later. And he's designed for barbecue nights. But so that's also the sort of the constant excitement of what we can do because you're just developing new products, yeah. But you've got to have your essentially
what
your
you
core.
Stand for.
Yeah, yeah. And that's really coming through the sort of. How we manufacture the knives. Yeah.
And you've got to be really, really clear. Yeah. We had, I'm not very good at names. We had that lovely chap, Cosmo, I think his name is, who had the mobile distillery,
yes.
The gin thing.
We have
a very, very clear offering. Mm. And whilst he might refine it around the edges, you know what what it is and what it stands for and how it stands out.
Exactly, yeah. So and the thing that's so exciting to me in all the interviews that we do here and the people we get to meet and chat to is that everyone is, you know, so keen about doing the thing that they're passionate about and making it the best. Not in the corporate world it's all about making it fastest or cheapest or, you know, the biggest scale, whereas here everyone really cares about it and they will put everything into making the thing the best that it can be for that customer who they can really picture, which is that's really exciting.
And I can see with yours the sort of scale of yours, but if green cola takes off, you know, but given your background, are you going to have to, you know, give in to some of the corporate pressures as you get bigger? Or are you determined to keep the culture? Because it's hard. The more people you get, the harder it is for everybody to share what you believe in.
Well, I'd like to have that problem in the first place. That's definitely what we call a first world problem. So for us, I think, no. We if you're talking about selling out at some point, that's not the reason we got into doing it. We got into it because we are literally three friends who are shunning corporate life for one reason or another. And we actually do want to get out of bed every day and say that I'm doing something because I believe in it. And that's really important.
So you don't
important.
Want to swap that corporate life for another one?
No, that's not the point, they probably don't want me either, Sue. So
yeah,
fine.
Okay. Yeah. Brilliant. Well, we've come to the end of the show again. Philip Shaw, love the Savanac knives.
Beautiful.
Really great.
Thank you.
And as I said before, all that information will be on our website. Really lovely. And when you hold one, you can just tell the difference, can't you, Guy?
Yeah.
Absolutely tell the difference. And I really do think that what you're doing, Jamie, is just, it's really important.
Hugely, yeah.
And hopefully you guys can try it out next time, yeah?
Yeah. Mm. Bit of cheap food coming on the way home.
I haven't had any lunch, so.
Yeah, so Jamie Crummy, too good to go. You need to go and download the app in the first instance. That's the starting point, isn't it?
Yeah.
So download the app, and I hope that really takes off. It's a really worthwhile thing, and we need lots of corporates to make sure they get on there, don't they, to get their food on there in the first place, as well as loads of consumers wanting to buy it.
Definitely.
Excellent. And then green cola. Now, where can we get this from? Where are you?
Well, you can get it from Amazon. Amazon sales are flying at the moment, I'm pleased to say.
Brilliant.
Which is great. The more people we talk to, the better it is. You can also get it from Ocado or from Tesco cafes. And then hopefully there'll be, well, we are in about 100 delis and cafes in London at the moment. And one or two other customers that we're hoping to be in later on this year.
So that's greencola.com, spelt as it sounds.
Correct.
Greencola.com. I don't particularly like Coca-Cola. That's fine.
I feel really okay having that. I drink, you know, Coke Zero like it's going out of fashion, but I will be swapping my Ocado order for some green cola.
There you go. So thank you again to Philip, Jamie and Paul. You've been listening to the Food Talk Show. We're syndicated to dozens of radio stations, as you all know. We're on iTunes, Podbean. You can also download us on the podcast app on your phone. And thanks again to Guy. Thank you very much, as
thank
always.
Thank you very much, Sue.
You're the nice half, aren't you, of the show?
Nice half.
Yeah, because I'm the horrible one that's a bit mean, and you're the soft, fluffy, lovely one.
Oh, that's so nice. It's
the nicest thing I've ever said to you in 2 years.
You're just lying, I can tell.
And if you do come across something groundbreaking yourself and you really think it should be on this show, because we like a bit of innovation, get in touch with us via Twitter on @FoodTalkShow. And of course, we've got hundreds of podcasts, and you can find out all about these guys we've had today on foodtalk.co.uk. And you can still, there's still some available, buy tickets for the Food Talk Awards. It's going to be amazing, but you better hurry up on that one. And we look forward to speaking to you next week. Bye now.